So, although you won't be able to see my screen, we all have our Bibles and such in front of us. So, we left off last week was we were, I guess the focus of this book has now come down to this character, Antiochus the Fourth, which he called himself Epiphanes, which meant like gift from God, and but they called him secretly, he was called Epiphany, which meant basically crazy, lunatic. Was he was kind of interesting, and we've seen how, you know, and I guess I was just, not to get it, I'm trying to stay away from the history lesson things when it's not, I mean, we could go through all the intrigue of this. I guess I've really never super looked at it in the depth that I have lately. I mean, it's just like in Europe, post, you know, Napoleon and the House of whatever. All the, if you go into the history of the European royal families, they're all related. They're all cousins and second cousins, and everybody's killing their brother and sister so they can get to the throne, and it's just intrigue. And I was looking at, I was just like, what do I do with this, Lord? I was just kind of praying about this, and to not make it a history lesson, that I wanted it to just, you know, to speak to us. But I guess, and that was what my prayer was this morning. Out of all of it, what I got was the Lord basically saying, do you trust me? And all this, I don't, hopefully nobody in this room is the, I don't know, so let me, oh, it is. So, nobody is depending on the details in this portion of Scripture to base your faith on. But I think the Lord is willing to meet anybody. There might be people that through they have an interest in you know, Greek history, and through that, as they look at all this intrigue and all this chaos, that they could say, well, wait a minute. There was a group of Jews that were in Alexandria, was basically Alexandria, Egypt, was the place where, there, I don't know if all you guys know about the library in Alexandria, was like one of the wonders of the world. It's where all the writings were stored in human history up to that point and stuff. Well, as part of that, a bunch of Jews had ended up in Alexandria, Egypt. Well, they all got together. The world at that time spoke Greek, and Greek was imposed on everybody. And although Hebrew was used, much like I would say, I guess to me, I was never raised Roman Catholic, but I know that they used Latin in a lot of their ceremonial things, used Latin. And that's basically the way Hebrew was. So, for the laity and the common people, they gathered together 70 to 72. There's some arguments about exactly how many. But that's how we get the word Septuagint. So they basically combed through the Scriptures. They took the 70 or 72 best minds of the time, combed through the Scriptures, and came up with a version of the Tanakh, which is the Old Testament, which obviously didn't have the New Testament at that time. And they came up with a version of the Bible called the Septuagint, which basically means 70. So that was written before these instances that we're going through with the king of the south attacked the king, it's mostly the king of the north attacked the king of the, and it just, I mean, you talk about divine intervention. Of all these things, for the two most powerful, we studied how four generals basically came out of Alexander's kingdom that he had established in Greece, that four major generals. Out of that, Ptolemy ended up in the what we would call Egypt and the Sinai, and the Succulid, General Succulid, ended up in what now would be like Lebanon, Syria, and all the way across, all the way across to India, which had been conquered again by Alexander the Great. Well, when his divine intervention of all things, as those two generals warred, the land that became the battleground that they constantly, as one was winning, he would cross from north down to south through Judea, through Israel. Then, you know, there's times when he lost, the king of the south, the Ptolemies would come up through Jerusalem. So Jerusalem was this constantly in flux. And a couple times, which this goes through, Israel kind of picked a side, thinking, you know, they were mistreated by this guy. When they were conquered by this guy, they sided with them, and they were okay with that, which led to some bad things. But then what would happen was then that king would lose to the other king from the north. He would realize the Jews, or he would know that the Jews had colluded, for lack of a better term, with the other king, so he would seek to punish them. And that's so that's the basic history lesson of this, and I was trying to think, what do I do with this? How do I present this to you? And I guess another thing I wrestle with is I feel terrible just sitting here rambling on. I wish somehow everybody could get involved, and I try, but it's just a tough part to understand the Bible, and I was really just honestly lamenting over it. I was not looking forward to teaching this week. It was, you know, just a tough thing, and what I got out of it, what kind of spoke to my spirit was, A, I just wanted people to trust me. Through all this, I was in control. In all, the fact that he goes in there, and I mean, I told you the story of the one, so they tried to stop the war by the brother, one of the kings in the Ptolemaic kingdom wanted his daughter, which was a common thing, to marry the king in the Succulid empire. You know, that was a common thing. Great. One little problem. The guy's already married. So he's trying to get rid of his wife who was in the third kingdom over in Asia Minor, which we would call Turkey now. And she hears about it. She grabs the people of her little, you know, around her. She rides down to meet him and her, and she poisons them both and kills both of them and puts her 10-year-old son on the throne. So, I mean, that's how much, and that's kind of alluded to in here in the scriptures. And basically, the Lord just spoke to me and said, even in all this chaos, I'm telling you about everything that's going on, and we will read through the scriptures in just a minute, that I just want you to know, do you trust me? That I've got this, that I'm letting, you know, we learn in Romans that one of the things that the Lord will do as a punishment to you, he'll let you have what you want. He will let you do just exactly what you want, and it will lead to destruction. And that's kind of what I got out of this. He's letting these people do what they want. You want to rule the world? Have at it. You know, have at it. So we've seen times when he picked people, as we know, he called Darius my servant. And we saw last week that when the angel was speaking to Daniel, he's like, I went to strengthen Darius. So, you know, we laughed about the funny little devil on one side and the angel on one side of your shoulder. But there seems to be a little, as a leader, you get to pick which little voice in your head you're going to follow. And if you pick rightly, it looks like the Lord sends people to help you make those decisions and do things. And on the other hand, he just makes decisions anyway because this is his plan. So that's kind of what I got, and it's kind of interesting because, to be honest with you, and we were discussing, and most, if you go through this, and most people, and that's why I read the thing in Ezekiel 28 and Isaiah 7, I can't remember, where we read that he started talking to the king of Tyre, the prophet did, He says, oh, King of Tyre, you think you did this, you think you did that. Then he says, oh, and you were in Eden. And you were, and you start thinking, no, he wasn't in Eden. And then you start realizing he's pulled back the curtain and said, hey, the guy that's behind you, I see, and I'm going to tell you what's going to happen to him. So that's kind of what we get out of here. What I kind of got out of this was, this is the chaos that Israel has been, was doing at this time. Well, guess what? Israel is in that exact same chaos now. Nothing has changed. They are in the middle, the kingdom of the town, Egypt. Egypt has made war with them, the 1967, the Six-Day War. You can look at all that, how many border skirmishes they've had, how they tried to make peace, how that was the Sadat thing when he got killed and assassinated. We've watched the kingdom of the north would be Lebanon, Syria. We see them constantly at war with it. Israel basically has no real natural resource. God just, it's funny because the Lord said, I have no comeliness that men would desire me for my looks or whatever. And it's the same way with Israel. They have no natural resources. It's a little pimple on the world, the globe. But yet, God said, all the kingdoms of the world are going to stumble over this and going to fight over this. And we see that playing out. And I think, so that's what I got out of this. I was like, yeah, we're going to go through, and there's a little bit of a history lesson in here. But the Lord just saying, they're mine. I have this. They're going through things for reasons you don't know. Anything I would say would be speculation. But the bottom line is I have this. And there's going to be a kingdom of the north come, which modern day to us, as most guys that are like the prophetic people, believe that the kingdom of the north now would be Moscow. And it's kind of interesting that if you go through the history of modern Israel, the country that has armed all of Israel's enemies has been Moscow. So that continues. So again, we see the, you know, the kingdom of the south. We see the times that the Egyptians have come against them and everything. So with that said, that's how I will try to go through this and give a minor little history thing in here where I can, but basically that's what I think. And the other side of that, I was going to tell you, around verse 35, this flips, and we go through what's happening in, you know, I guess it goes from like 330 BC to 120 BC, and then all of a sudden the script flips to the future, and so there's this like, there's a prophecy that's fulfilled at that moment, and then there's a prophecy that's fulfilled later. And like I told you, to us, we view prophecy as we're reading this. And the Lord said, this king will come here, and he's going to do this. And 500 years later, this king comes here and does that. We say that was prophecy. Israel viewed prophecy a little differently. They have a model. We see Boaz as the kinsman redeemer. He comes in, he grabs a piece of land that redeems it for a widow, but in doing that, he gets a Gentile bride. And we see that as a kinsman redeemer. Is that one of the roles of Jesus Christ? So therefore, that is how they view prophecy. So we're going to get this Antioch IV, Epiphanes, we're going to view him as a model of the Antichrist. And we're going to see him get viewed as that model. We see Nero get viewed as that model, who, once the kingdom goes, we're going to be introduced to the Romans at this point. The Greek empires, if you will, all those Greek generals, their empires are fading, and there's a little city that's starting to come to power, and one of the ways they project power is they were the first country really to have a foursome navy. Like, their navy moved all around the Mediterranean, started conquering, and we're going to get introduced to that today. So we left off at verse 24. I'm sorry, I don't have anything up there. But well, it's kind of interesting. So we'll go back to verse 22. The overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and scattered, and also the Prince of the Covenant. So this kind of alludes to the Prince of the Covenant gives a little bit of pause. I was trying to go through that, but most people don't think it's what we would think, like the Lord or somebody, a Prince of the Covenant. But this might allude to the priest, the high priest at this time in Israel. That was, if anybody was here and saw the little video we played, it got to the point that the Greeks started picking the high priest. And in doing that, obviously, the high priest was beholden to the Greeks, and some of them led the effort in Hellenizing the Jews, which we saw led to the Maccabee Revolt, Hanukkah, and it's a shame I had that. I might have it in here. All right, so the forces he's defeated, and after alliance is made in tranquility, he will practice deception. He will gain power with a small force of people. This is Antiochus coming to the throne. Back then, it was a whole bunch of secret backroom deals, kind of like USAID. No, I didn't say it. It was just, you know, really, really shaky stuff the way. And it's kind of interesting if you go through history, and I was watching something completely different from this, and it came, but small groups of people end up, if they become really, really devoted to what they're doing, they end up becoming a major player. And they say, if you know anything about the American Revolution, 30% of the colonists wanted revolution. 30% of the colonists wanted to stay allied with England, and the rest in the middle didn't care. But obviously the 30% was a very boisterous group of people and got the Declaration of Independence signed, and off to war we went, thank God. And then there's all throughout history we see the Bolshevik revolution in Russia. Same thing, small group of people, probably 30% of the population. 30% of the population opposed them. Most of the people in the middle were just trying to eat and stay alive, so they didn't care. So next thing you know, that devoted 30% of the population comes to power. And that's kind of how Antiochus Epiphanes came to power, through a small group, got behind him. They were very powerful, but yet small, and they brought him to power. And in a time of tranquility, he will enter the parts of the realm, and he will accomplish what his fathers never did, nor his ancestors, and he will distribute plunder, booty, possessions among them, and they will devise his schemes against strongholds, and he will devise his schemes against strongholds, but only for a time. So basically what he did when he came to power, all these other little people that had opposed him had their little city-state set up or there where their headquarters was, and they had gold and stuff. He went in and just plundered it and took it all and spread it all throughout his buddies. So, USAID again. Verse 25. He will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south with a large army. So the king of the south will mobilize an extremely large and mighty army for war, but he will not stand, for schemes will be devised against him. So basically, the Ptolemaic Empire raised an army like twice the size of Antiochus the Fourth, and he marched down again through Israel, down into Egypt, into the Sinai. They met in battle. But it was weird how all the generals that were dispersed throughout the kingdom have been with the four original generals, and their loyalty could be bought, or could be, if they thought there was a better deal coming, they would switch sides back and forth constantly. So that's kind of what happened to him. He had this super large army, but when the army kingdom of the north came down and invaded him, some of his generals decided, hey, I could get a better deal on the other side, and they stabbed him in the back, and they lost the battle. And what was, I don't know who, the Ptolemy, the 55th for all I know, but whoever, believe it or not, they were cousins, basically. That, like, all, it ended up like all the generals and their offspring and all, like, all intermarried. And like I said, it was just like Europe, that everybody was kind of related, second, third cousin. Not everybody, but a lot of the leaders were all related. So they were cousins. And in, so in verse 26 it says, those who eat his choice food will destroy him, and his army will overthrow, but many will fall down and slain. So he's talking about how he was betrayed by some of his generals that had, that he had taken care of, but when it came time to fight, they switched sides. Verse 27, as for both kings, their hearts will be intent on evil, and they will speak lies to each other at the same table. But it will not succeed, for the end is still to come at the appointed time. So basically what they did, since he was his cousin, he sat down and they would actually eat. He became his mentor, if you will, which had to be interesting at the dinner table, because I think they both were plotting how to kill each other. So this is just the intrigue of, you know, humanity throughout time. But basically, Antiochus the Fourth took him under, said, hey, you're my boy, I'm going to take care of you, and he let him live, basically, even though he lost the battle. So then he will return to his land with much plunder, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he will take action that return to his own land. So what happens is he goes to Jerusalem down to fight with the king of the south. He comes back up through. In that time, like what we saw, if anybody can remember back, there had been a revolt, and the high priest, one of the high priests, I think his name was Jason, had revolted against the high priest that had been installed by Antiochus on his way down. So on his way back, he finds out about this revolt, and he's not happy. So he kills all of them and puts the other guy back as a high priest. That's basically, then it just kind of goes home. Verse 29, at the appointed time he will return and come into the south, but this last time will not turn out the way it did before. It's kind of interesting. So they end up betraying each other. So he says, okay, I've had enough of this guy. I'm going to go down and finally do what I should have done the first time. Then in verse 30, we see another group get involved. For ships of Kittim will come against him. That's actually the Roman navy I was talking about. Therefore, he will be disheartened and return and become enraged at the Holy Covenant and take action. So he will come back and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So basically, what's that saying? He runs up against, he's going to go down and he gets humiliated and has to retreat in front of the Roman navy. And, you know, obviously they brought infantry with them, and he ends up retreating, so he kind of gets humiliated. So now he's walking back to Israel. This time he's mad, so you couldn't get circumcised, you couldn't worship on the Sabbath, you couldn't read the Tanakh or the Septuagint. He was intent on Hellenizing all the Jews, and so he will come back, and basically when it says, so he will come back and show regard for those who were sent. So basically he elevated any, as we saw in the thing, a lot of the upper class and mercantile class of the Jews were totally happy with being Hellenized if they could profit from it and live a comfortable life. So that's what they're talking about there. He showed regard for those who, because they were basically doing what he wanted to. He wanted to Hellenize the Jews, and they were taking part of that. Forces will arise and desecrate the sanctuary fortress. So they tore down the walls of the city and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. And it's a shame. You can see the color. I make pretty colors and stuff, and you can't see them. But to understand what is an abomination throughout the whole Old Testament, as we've been all the way from Joshua, an abomination is, God calls it an abomination to worship another god. He says, that's an abomination in my eyes. He constantly tells Israel, you committed an abomination. You committed, well, the ultimate abomination that would cause desolation would, okay, not only are we going to worship an idol and a false god, we're going to worship it in Jerusalem. Well, how can I make that even worse? We're going to put it in the temple. Well, how can I make that even worse? I'm going to stick it in the Holy of Holies. And if you know anything, he sacrificed a pig, which is, you know, you can't get in Jewish faith, you can't get any worse than that as a pig, it's unclean. And then he set up an idol to Zeus. He turned the temple in Jerusalem into a temple of Zeus. And that is what's known as the abomination of desolation. Why is that important? Anybody? Who talks about it? A couple hundred years later, Jesus talks about it. So that's one of the things he said, when you see the abomination of desolation, flee. So if you didn't know what the abomination of desolation was, you wouldn't know when to flee, right? So this is Jewish prophecy. There's a model. This guy is the model. He went into the temple, he set this up, and did this. So when Jesus says you're going to see this again, you're seeing this is Jewish prophecy. This is the model, then the fulfillment. You know, the actual thing's going to happen again. So that's why that's pretty important. And what does that, it's kind of weird in what we're seeing today. What does that say has to be around in the future? What has to be there for there to be abomination of desolation? A temple, right? So as we watch, if anybody's been watching these things, they have to count the spots on a red heifer. He can have so many red hairs and stuff. Well, they have seven that they got from Texas. You can look this up, it's nothing. And right now they're waiting for them. They have to be at least 3 years old, right? Is that what the?
I don't know.
So they're waiting for these
seven in Jerusalem. They're inspecting.
Right. So they basically had the animals. Well, how is that important? Well, you have to take a red heifer, you have to sacrifice it, then his ashes are what's used to bless all the implements that are going to be used in the temple. So all the implements have been made. So through the gains that have been made in the DNA searches, they found priests that are in the line that they should be in, and they have the priests, they have the implements, they're waiting for the red heifer. And I know this becomes a thing of contention of, you know, then if you ever, well, I kind of find a lot of, like you said, I know you all heard my little proclivity for history thing, that, so I watch a couple of biblical archaeology shows, and there's some pretty compelling evidence that because when, the king that was, or the ruler of Israel when the Lord was there, when he built his temple, Herod, God, why could I not think that? When they built Herod's temple, they might have built it in the wrong place. So now there's some pretty good evidence. So what happened to Herod's temple? It was turned long thousand history later, it's turned into the Al-Aqsa Mosque. So that's like this dominating thing you see. And so you say, well, there could never be a temple because there would be war, because you would have to tear down this mosque that is supposedly the holiest thing in Islam. Well,
I believe that with the dome is now where they originally thought it was going to be, but they discovered that off to the side, further, is the actual spot by going from the line through from the Mount of Olives. It's not over here, it's over there.
And that is true. That is what. Now, there might be a case that they might be able to build a temple and not disturb the mosque. So, you know, you kind of watch that. Jesus is constantly, and the Holy Spirit's like, do you trust me? Because you just look at things that are going on in the world, and you're like, I don't know. Are you seeing this, Lord? Are you seeing this? You know, am I? And he's constantly like, he has to talk to your spirit and say, do you trust me? I got this. There's a reason this is happening. And you got to look at, I mean, as terrible as it is to say, how did the Jews end up back in Israel? The Holocaust, right? That softened the world's hard enough for that. It, trust me, it only lasted for, and then they hated them again. But in that little window that opened, Israel was born, and Israel was formed. They fought an unbelievable war and kept their land. And it's just, so we're looking at events that are going on in the world, and we're like, God, I don't think you're in this. I don't see you in this. And he's like, just trust me. I got this. You don't see it. You don't know what the plan is. You don't know the chess pieces I'm moving on the board. But I honestly, with this biblical archaeology, it's kind of interesting how much they gave Jordan, I believe, control of the Temple Mount. So they will not let them excavate under the Temple Mount. Well, they started doing it somewhere else for some other reason, and that's how they kind of stumbled across where they think they have chromo, because there were some tunnels under the Holy of Holies, and there was this, and they have stumbled across what they believe is those tunnels. So, as you watch this unfold, and it's kind of interesting because we see there's going to be a time of calmness. And it's kind of, so I look at suspicion at when we're going to have a peace treaty and we're going to be this, because the Bible says when they say peace, peace, destruction is going to come upon them. So, you know, and that's just my, I don't know, I'm hoping, you're supposed to pray for the peace of Jerusalem, and I hope it sticks. But it's also kind of strange when you watch some of the people involved in it. So, verse 32. By smooth words, he will turn to godlessness those who act wickedly toward the covenant, but the people who know their God will display their strength and take action. Those who have insight among the people will give an understanding to many, yet they will fall by the sword and by the flame, by captivity and by plunder for many days. I believe that's what they're talking about, the Maccabean revolt. That, you know, they renewed, for 3 years they threw off the rule of the Greeks, but they ended up getting the Romans. So, verse 34. Now they fall, they will be granted a little help, and many will join with them in hypocrisy. So it just goes to show the people that started to line themselves. It's constantly, it's like with the church, when the church is being prosecuted, it's the most effective and most diligent and everything. You know, there's no reason to be a Christian if you're going to get killed. But if it gets you some kind of reward, there's always, you know, and that's kind of what happened here. They're talking about there's some hypocrisy in getting involved. To those who got involved, kind of again started to water down the faith. Some of those who have insight will fall in order to refine, purge, and to make pure until the end time, because it is still to come at the appointed time. So here where we see that place where we go from, we've been talking about history, now we can see that, and now we're kind of going to go into the future. So 36, I'll wrap it up here. Then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. So you can look at that. This was kind of Antiochus, Nero, always, you know, exclaim themselves as the God or from the gods and all this. But you can see this is saying this will be finished. But we keep seeing these people keep coming, so it obviously isn't finished. So this is starting to talk about this leader that's going to come forth in the future. And this is where, so I'll kind of knock it off here that we're done, but we will kind of start talking about the future world leader, which I guess kind of where everybody wanted to go. It's a little rough on me. But so there's like you know, a couple verses left in this chapter, and then the next chapter is kind of short. So we'll have time to finish next week, barring weather catastrophes or catastrophes, or the rapture. So, sorry, I know that was a little, I struggled with that one, so if anybody